Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janat Jalil, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 21st of August, these are our main stories. The Italian Prime Minister resigns after accusing his coalition partner of creating a political crisis for personal gain. Sudan forms a sovereign council to lead the country from military rule to democracy. President Trump confirms he's considering new tax cuts amid growing concerns about the economy. Also in this podcast,
they've chucked out the males and they've just kept the females, but they've carried on reproducing and producing new generations.
Why have one group of female stick insects given up on sex? We begin in Italy, where the president, Sergio Mattarella, has accepted the resignation of Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte, ending the populist coalition between the far-right League Party and the anti-establishment Five Star Movement. This follows weeks of hostility between the coalition partners, which culminated in the League leader, Matteo Salvini, calling for early elections. In an angry resignation speech in the Senate, Mr. Conte accused Mr. Salvini of putting his personal ambitions before the welfare of the country.
When we take on important institutional positions and sign up to governmental contracts, we must be aware that we are taking on specific duties and responsibilities towards our citizens, and we cannot just set these aside whenever it suits us.
Mr. Salvini, meanwhile, made his pitch to become Italy's next Prime Minister.
This is what I would like to offer Italians: a future of growth, development, prosperity, well-being, family and courage.
Our diplomatic correspondent James Robbins followed the debate.
It was a pretty angry afternoon in the Italian Senate. Felt quite operatic, frankly. Plenty of passion and fury. But this is a serious issue because Italy is used to unstable governments, used to governments not lasting very long. But it's in a very bad economic place at the moment, running a record deficit and a debt that has now reached over 130% of annual income. And there's nervousness across Europe and across many of the markets about what this further evidence of instability could mean.
And Mr. Salvini has been accused of trying to force fresh elections for his own political advantage, but that's not necessarily going to happen, is it?
It's not. I mean, it's a charge which could stick if he gets his way. Matteo Salvini was obviously hugely bolstered by municipal elections and by the European elections in Italy. He thinks he could rule on his own as prime minister. But equally, many others in Italy think this is awful timing, that they need to focus on a fairly strict budget and also on constitutional reform, which would have the effect of reducing by about a third the number of elected members of parliament. So there's a big agenda which would be lost if it couldn't be done before elections. Matteo Salvini says he's going to allow time for a consideration of the budget, but actually he's going to stand on a ticket, if he gets elections, of going to Brussels and saying, it's time you relaxed the Eurozone rules, made it easier for Italy to spend rather than us always having to cut our spending.
James Robbins. After months of protests, violence and negotiations, Sudan's generals and pro-democracy leaders have finally formed a sovereign council that will steer the country through 3 years of transition from military to civilian rule. The council is made up of 6 civilians and 5 military officers, and it replaces the transitional military council that took over from the longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir when he was forced from power in April. Our Middle East correspondent Sally Nabil has more.
After a delay of 2 days, Sudan's sovereign council will finally be sworn in. The council is going to run the country during the transitional period. It will be headed by Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the current leader of the transitional military council. According to the constitutional declaration, the sovereign council will be headed by a military person for 21 months. A civilian will then take over for 18 months until fresh elections are held in 2022. The governing body, made up of 11 members, was supposed to be sworn in on the 19th of August, but the opposition coalition failed to agree on a list of 5 civilian candidates and asked for more time to have further talks. The council will have 5 military members too, in addition to an 11th member who has to be agreed upon by the civilian and military blocs. They decided on a Christian lady. Perhaps they want to send a message of assurance to the Christian community in Sudan, who have repeatedly complained about persecution under former President Omar al-Bashir.
Sally Nabil. The economy is doing tremendously well. The words of President Trump as he's tried to play down warnings of a possible recession. Yet he's now admitted that he's considering new tax cuts and has again called on the US Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, to reduce interest rates to boost the economy.
We're looking for a rate cut. We could be really greatly helped if the Fed would do its job and do a substantial rate cut. Also, we're looking at various tax reductions, but I'm looking at that all the time anyway.
Our White House reporter, Tara McKelvey, gave me more details about what Mr. Trump said.
Mr. Trump says that the economy is great, and he says it's just the media that's trying to get people worried about a possible recession. But he's also reassuring people. He talked about the possibility of a variety of tax cuts. He talked about payroll tax cuts, and that would be a big help for workers. They'd see more money in their paychecks. And he also talked about a particular kind of tax cuts for investors. These would be tax breaks on profits that people earn when they're selling their assets. It's kind of an exclusive tax cut that would only affect like the top 0.1% of taxpayers. And this way, President Trump is saying, no need to worry about the economy. Here's what I'm doing for you. Or here's some of my plans.
And this all comes amid growing concerns about a possible recession. And Mr. Trump has got his eye firmly fixed on re-election hopes for next year.
That's right. President Trump knows how important the economy is to the people here in this country. And he's also there's been some concerns about the U.S.-China trade war. President Trump says that he's standing tall on that front and he's carrying on with his plan. He's defended the U.S. tariffs policy. And he also said that people should be not concerned about the economy. He said recently that he gave at a rally in New Hampshire, he talked about the strong economy. And he said, love me or hate me, you have to vote for me. And he said, otherwise, your retirement savings are going to go down the tubes. He knows people are concerned about it. He's trying to remind them, at least in his view, that he's the person that they should have in office.
Tara McKelvey. Lebanon is a country with a delicate balance of faiths, but sometimes the tensions and the discrimination display themselves. In one suburb of Beirut, members of a Muslim Shia family have been asked to leave their home simply because it's in a Christian neighbourhood. The incident has revived the debate about the fragility of coexistence between different religions. Karin Torby reports.
Muhammad and his family have not yet had time to unpack their kitchen utensils. Plates and pans are still lying on the floor in plastic boxes. They brought them from their old apartment, from which they were forced to leave, simply because they are Shia Muslims. Muhammad told us that the local authorities cut off electricity and water supplies to his house. Then he was told bluntly that he couldn't stay there and that his house deed will never be signed by one of the relevant authorities. And he was given money to move out.
The mayor told me that members of my family are veiled and that this creates an obstacle for our stay here. He said to me, aren't you aware that Muslims are not allowed to live here? I replied, a Muslim can't live here. I'm Lebanese before anything else. And as Lebanese, I can live in any part of the country.
Muhammad's old apartment is located not far from Beirut, in Hadath, which used to be a Christian town. But after the civil war ended in 1990, the area saw an influx of Shia Muslims that tilted its demographics. Today, the municipality is adamant about stopping any further exchange of property from Christians to Muslims. Purple banners along the main road in the Christian side of the town call on people to refrain from selling their property or land. It warns that the municipality would not sign any such transaction. The mayor championing this policy, a man holding his position for the 10th year in a row now, claims that his measures aim at preserving the identity of Hadath. His name is George Aoun.
This decision has been approved by all religious authorities and political parties, Christians and Muslims. The most important element of the Lebanese system is to preserve the coexistence between members of different religions. The demographical change that could lead to the end of Christians' presence in the area contradicts and damages the coexistence. Others do it in less open fashion. We are proud of it.
The mayor's decision is unconstitutional, yet it has been politically tolerated, partly because of the current political alliance between the main Christian and Shia political parties. For Rima Majid, who teaches a course on sectarianism at the American University of Beirut, Hadass's case is neither unique nor surprising.
It's surprising to an outside observer. It's not that surprising for someone following Lebanese politics for a while. But if we remember in 2008, for example, we saw very similar practices amongst Sunni and Shia as well. Political sectarianism and its implications on social sectarianism have been very reinforced. It's now institutionalized. It's in the constitution. And this brings up demographic fears.
Lebanon prides itself on being a country of religious coexistence in the Middle East, and its political system is based on power sharing between Christians and Muslims. And here in downtown Beirut, a landmark church and mosque stand back to back. This is the iconic image that Lebanon boasts of. But on the ground, some practices seem to challenge that celebrated image.
Karin Torby. Most of us know to steer clear of suspicious emails to prevent hackers accessing personal information on a computer. But a new study by the Southern Methodist University in Dallas has found it's possible to use a smartphone to work out what someone is typing. This report from Oliver Conway.
Picture the scene. You're in a business meeting making confidential notes on your laptop, but by simply placing a smartphone on the table, researchers in Texas have shown they can find out what you're typing from the sound of your keystrokes. Mitchell Thornton led the study for the Darwin Deason Institute of Cybersecurity.
We wanted something that was very realistic. We wanted to really find out in an ordinary setting if someone is perhaps typing a text or an email during a meeting, if that could be picked up by the smartphone and then deciphered. We can, with our method, pick up about 41% of what is being typed.
This sounds like a worrying security issue.
It could potentially be. I don't think everyone should get overly alarmed.
And that is because at the moment, the hackers need to know what material the table's made of in order to successfully interpret the sound waves. However, given that most smartphones have sensors which can pick up the keystrokes, you may want to be a bit more cautious the next time you use a laptop in a coffee shop, library or train.
Oliver Conway there. Still to come on this podcast?
It's hard, so hard. A young man, full of life, with children. He left a family behind.
We investigate the worrying number of deaths among people working on salmon farms in Chile. Wildfires in the Amazon rainforest have reached record levels in the first half of this year, with more than 70,000 fires detected so far. The surge has occurred since the far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, took office, vowing to develop the Amazon region for farming and mining. Our Americas editor, Candace Peart, reports.
Asked whether he was doing enough to control the wildfires, President Bolsonaro brushed off the criticism, saying it was the time of year when farmers use fire to clear the land. According to Brazil's Space Research Center, fires have increased by 82% compared to the same period last year. Satellite images show Brazil's most northern state, Roraima, covered in dark smoke. Neighbouring Amazonas has declared an emergency. On Monday, far to the south, night fell early in São Paulo City because of thick cloud carrying smoke from the Amazon.
Candace Peart. The American space agency NASA has confirmed that it's planning an ambitious mission to one of Jupiter's moons. The goal is to find out if there's an ocean below the ice-encrusted surface of Europa that could support life. This report by Stephanie Prentice.
Europa is the most likely place to find life in our solar system today because we think there's a liquid water ocean beneath its surface.
It's the mission that almost seemed impossible. A hunt for alien life on a moon surrounded by radiation that nobody wanted to pay for. But after decades of planning, the team at NASA have been given the go-ahead with the final stage to look for life on one of Jupiter's moons.
Now, we know that on Earth, everywhere that there's water, we find life.
The goal is to build a spacecraft to conduct an in-depth exploration of it, examining ways to target the thick ice crust there using 9 specific instruments. Below the ice crust is thought to be a deep body of water capable of sustaining life. This is due to the gravitational pull of nearby Jupiter, which creates the kind of tides and heat which are known to support life on Earth. The challenges, though, are plentiful. Europa's orbital path takes it deep into belts of radiation which can fry spacecraft electronic systems. This means the mission has to perform a series of careful flybys. The mission and necessary follow-up missions also have somewhat shaky backing, after taking decades for the budget for this stage to be approved. NASA, however, are confident. Director Thomas Zurbuchen saying the mission moves mankind one step closer to advancing our understanding of life elsewhere, unlocking the mysteries of an ocean world. It's expected to launch by 2023.
Stephanie Prentice reporting there. Chile is the world's second largest producer of salmon, and it accounts for nearly a third of global supply. The salmon industry has provided thousands of jobs for people in southern Chile. But a recent study suggests there's a worrying number of deaths among people working on salmon farms. Grace Livingston reports from the island of Chiloé in the Los Lagos region of Chile.
It's a misty morning and I'm standing by a lead grey sea dotted with fishing boats and fishing nets. Along the shore here are lots of little wooden houses, brightly coloured but weather-beaten. Ancut used to be a little fishing village, but now most people here work for the big salmon farming industry.
Mi nombre es Patricio Benjamín Guayquil Barrea.
Patricio Guayquil Barrea was a diver in the salmon farms for 18 years. He's left now, having seen two friends die. One of them was his wife's cousin.
He was delousing the fish. He got trapped under the tarpaulin and couldn't get out.
To delice salmon, divers have to swim down and put a tarpaulin round the bottom of the salmon pen so the pesticides don't wash away. Mario Gaicheo drowned in 2015 when he got stuck between the bottom of the salmon pen and the tarpaulin with the weight of hundreds of fish on top of him.
It's hard, so hard. A young man, full of life, with children. He left a family behind.
There are about 6,000 divers working for the salmon industry here. In the last 6 years, 11 divers working on salmon farms in Chile have died, and 12 boatmen transporting the fish have also died, according to the NGO Eco Oceanos. In the same period, no workers have died on salmon farms in Norway, the world's biggest salmon producer. This is the headquarters of Marea Roja, an association of divers and fishermen's groups. Pablo Ayaso, a diver in the salmon industry for 20 years, is its president.
The salmon companies don't respect the procedures to protect divers or the diving regulations. There's a rule that basic level divers can only go down to a depth of 20 metres, but they don't respect the depth limits for basic level divers.
Divers' jobs include collecting the dead salmon that fall to the bottom of the pens and mending the underwater nets that sea lions bite holes in.
Where the dead salmon fall, there is a cone pointing downwards, and that's 3 or 4 metres below the bottom of the pen, so it's more than 20 metres, and divers have to go down there. And when divers check the anti-sea lion nets, these can be at depths of 30 or 40 metres.
Now I've come to meet Esteban Ramirez, the general manager of Salmon Chile, which represents the salmon companies.
Our association in the industry doesn't want any accidents. All companies are committed to looking after their workers. But it's true that there is a high risk for people working as divers, and the industry is taking action.
Salmon Chile says it's working with divers groups to discuss safety. However, it questions the figures of Eco Oceanos and categorically denies that divers are ordered to go below depths of 20 metres. But the divers I spoke to said more action is needed until they feel safe working on Chile's salmon farms.
That report was by Grace Livingston. To Rwanda now, where a beer company has come under fire over a sexist marketing campaign. Skol Rwanda has apologised for its new beer labels, which featured misogynistic jokes. Our Business Africa reporter Maggie Mutesi has the story.
The company unveiled the campaign under the theme Live Laugh Lager for one of its main brands. People were asked to send in jokes that would be printed on bottles. However, some of them have offended women. One portrayed women as materialistic. The joke read, "When can a woman make you a millionaire?" And when the bottle is turned upside down, the answer was, "When you're a billionaire." Many women in Rwanda spoke out against the campaign on Twitter, calling on consumers to boycott Skol products. One of those who condemned the campaign was the Rwandan Minister of Gender and Family Promotion, Soline Nyirahabimana, who said such language demeaning women was not acceptable in our country. She said it shouldn't be tolerated in this part of the world and should be punished by the law. Skol has called off the campaign and apologized for the offensive jokes, saying it was taking the matter seriously.
Maggie Mutesi. Now we're going to end the programme talking about stick insects. Well, one particular species of stick insect that came over to the UK from New Zealand in the early part of the last century on shiploads of plants. Perhaps there's something in the air here in Britain, but during that time, this particular kiwi stick insect has given up on sex entirely, reproducing asexually so that the whole population is now female. They've been studied by biologists back in New Zealand who've published their findings in the journal Nature. And one of those biologists is Professor Steve Trewick of Massey University. He spoke to my colleague, James Menendez.
Well, the marvellous thing that they've done is to give up on half of the population, as it were. They've chucked out the males and they've just kept the females, but they've carried on reproducing and producing new generations.
And how have they done that exactly?
Well, exactly, we don't quite know. But what we know is that the females can produce eggs, and the eggs hatch, and they hatch into females just like their mothers. They can then produce eggs and hatch into females like their grandmothers, and so it goes on.
Has it got anything to do with the fact that they came over to the UK?
Yes, not in terms of the genetics of the mechanism, but in terms of the change in situation. And probably the passage, you know, they're hitchhiking across the oceans on ships. And we think that what happened is that just a few eggs from New Zealand got all the way across to the Scilly Isles and hatched there. And by chance, there were no males. So presumably the eggs that hatched were female eggs and they produced little females and there were no males around. So they either would have disappeared, but they didn't. The females were able to carry on producing eggs without having sex.
And giving up on males.
Giving up on males completely, yes. A great saving. Waste of space males. They've got rid of those, and they just means that every single egg that they lay is a reproductive daughter to add more daughters and granddaughters into the future.
Sounds like a splendid idea, but I just wonder whether in evolutionary terms, is it better that they reproduce asexually or is it better to reproduce sexually?
Huge question that's been around in biological science for many, many years and is still debated. It seems as if both strategies work in some circumstances. we suspect that quite a lot of animal lineages do switches over to asexuality, but that they don't stay in asexuality, I mean only females, for very many generations. So long term, it seems like having males and females and having sex is largely beneficial. But short term, there's a numerical advantage because, of course, all of those offspring are immediately able to reproduce themselves.
So it could be a sort of temporary coping mechanism with a certain change in environment. Is that possible?
Well, that's right. It could be that that's how it works out. There's a kind of an escape route. After all, we wouldn't see the stick insects now in the Scilly Isles if they hadn't been able to do this little trick. But the very bizarre thing that we've observed from experimental work, because we then brought eggs from the Scilly Isles stick insects, they brought some of those eggs back and housed them specially in New Zealand and hatched them and grew them up. And then we presented those great-granddaughters from, 100 years of reproduction in the Scilly Isles, we presented them with males of the same species from New Zealand, and they got it on. They mated, but they couldn't produce fertile offspring from that mating. So the males recognized them as suitable mates. They were quite happy, but it came to nothing.
Professor Steve Treewick talking about the fascinating versatility of New Zealand's stick insects. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.